to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. Phil's an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and he is retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. It's great to have him back, and I hope you'll join in with your questions. What insects are you seeing out there? Have you got some great photos of insects? Maybe we can identify those. We can, or give it a shot anyway, if you go to our Facebook page and post those photos. The title of our Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show. So we'd certainly love those as well. And Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Great to have you with us. I know one of the things we wanted to talk about today was the Japanese beetle. And you know what? I'm going to go right to the phones because Tom in Milwaukee has a comment about Japanese beetles. Hi, Tom.
Hi, guys. It's about 2009 or 10 that this subject came up on your show, or it's come up a lot, but I had called in. We had so many here on our block or in the area here in Wanakee. It was just unbelievable. Well, this time, I think they've doubled up. And as I was telling your producer, I don't think we're going to have any trees or leaves to rake this fall because they're just nibbling away and falling like crazy. Is there anything that's brought them back? Phil, I know last time you said it's really sporadic. You could go a couple blocks away or other areas of the village and there wouldn't be any, and go around the corner and they're there. But what's bringing them back to the same spot with, or the same area with, I guess, something like we haven't seen for eight years or so?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, my experience of watching what's been happening is definitely Japanese beetles in general are up, probably because of the weather patterns of last year. But in Wanakee, I guess I can share, I have a brother-in-law that lives out there, and he's experienced the same thing. Now, he goes back to battling Japanese beetles for at least 10 years, and the general trend has been, over time, it gets better. But one of the things that I think why he's seeing a resurgence, and it may be related to yours also, is some of the recent developments around Wanakee. There is a lot of well-irrigated, sodded lawns that have all of a sudden appeared, which is Japanese beetle breeding heaven. And so the combination of overall the weather being conducive, the lushness of late last summer allowed for a much better breeding population, but also more habitat. And so it's interesting. I've talked on the show before. Dr. Phil Barak has always been nice enough to share with me his Japanese beetle trap counts in Madison. And, you know, he had documented what I had seen in my own yard is this, you know, almost a 50% reduction for a number of years in a row. Well, Phil was nice enough to email me this year and talk about the increases he's seen in his traps. And although I will say, and I only live a block from a golf course, so I probably should expect more problems than I've seen this year, it hasn't been a dramatic uptake in my yard, but my observations when I drive around the west side of Madison and whatnot is every linden tree is already browned up. And so they said, I think overall it's a combination of the weather being more conducive for better populations. But I think the added complication you have is you've got relatively close by larger areas of good breeding habitat. What happens in most of our lawns, if we don't water them, they go dormant. They don't do very well in those lawns. But this year, it's like everybody's been irrigating because of the rain. And as I said, so I just envision, unfortunately, that I think next year will be as intense, if not more intense, without some dramatic change.
My neighbor and I, we each have three lindens each in our front yard, and like you said, well, they're really munching away. But we treat it with the Bayer Advance, the concentrate, every about the end of April or so, around each of the trees, and that just doesn't seem to work. I mean, I don't know
what it would take. Huh?
Well, two things on the Bayer product. For very large trees, to be honest, you don't get a sufficient dosage if you follow label directions, and you can't use more than the label allows. But the other thing that has changed relatively recently is, honestly, it is no longer registered for use on linden trees because of pollinator issues. One of the problems has always been is lindens are so highly attractive to honeybees and other bees, and being a systemic, and so EPA has pulled that product. But going back to, you know, my observation is small trees, when you used to treat them with that particular product, you got reasonable control. But the bigger trees, when the populations are high, are always disappointing, and it probably is a fact that there's not enough chemical being applied to really get the you know, the way you figure out how much chemical is you measure the outside diameter of the tree. And, you know, if you double the diameter, you double the amount of product. Well, honestly, the amount of volume and leaf growth and everything is far more than double. So, as I said, there's a controversy there to begin with. And now, in particular, as I said, within the last 2 years in particular, that label use is no longer allowed. So,
anything else that can be applied on?
Well, the complication here is there's a lot of foliar products that will work for a short time, but the complication of spraying a large tree and then having to spray multiple times, it just isn't practical. Now, the good news about it is it's cosmetic. I mean, the trees are not going to die from this, but the bad news is they lose a lot of their aesthetic quality from the first part of July when these things really start rolling and they really don't recover. And again, it's messy because of all the leaf drop. Birch trees also are hit. Japanese maple is another favorite. And so in some cases, people have kind of looked at alternatives. Another tree that gets hit quite commonly are some of the elms. Some of the hybrid elms are quite susceptible to this leaf feeding. And so it is a difficult situation. And as I said, I'm not sure there is a good answer on how to keep those lindens going. The only thing, again, is to go back is one would assume that, you know, this might be a bit of a peak and things should start to lessen, but it might be 3 or 4 years before we see that benefit.
There we go. Thank you, Tom, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give LaVon in St. Croix County a chance to join us. LaVon, hi.
Hi. Thanks for being for having me on your show.
Sure.
I think I have pantry moths, and I have cleaned out everything in my kitchen that I could remotely think that they might be eating on. I find them most in the kitchen, and every once in a while they migrate to the back part of the house. And in the hardware store, I found little paper traps that seem to attract them, little triangular traps.
Mm-hmm.
But my bigger question is, will they eat wool products? Because I have a lot of wool products, hangings and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the diet is completely different. Wool moths need a high protein diet, so they can't breed off of grain, and the grain moths, particularly Indian meal moth is the most common, but there's a couple other ones, are purely, you know, starch-type based products, which can be any kind of dry goods, but will not feed on wool. Now, what gets complicated is that there's other things in your house other than what you have in the kitchen that are potential food sources. And so, you know, potpourri and Christmas wreaths made out of walnuts and all these other basically food-type products that are not used as food products could be a source. I always relate, you know, our own personal battle with them. It started in birdseed in our house. Then they got into our kitchen cupboards. We went through the cleanup. We put everything that was potentially susceptible that was not infested in plastic containers that would keep the critters out. And although it improved dramatically, there was always this trickle. And it was driving me crazy, and my wife was not happy with my professional expertise. And it took me about 6 to 7 months to solve the riddle. And what it turned out to be is there was a hardware store bag that had a bunch of vegetable seeds my father-in-law had given me years ago. I forgot about it. I put it on the shelf. I would have swore there were screws or some other kind of, you know, thing from the hardware store there. But that was the source. And so the problem gets to be is where could it be? It could be an old mouse bait that you threw a packet of mouse bait, you know, under the kitchen sink 4 years ago. And all of a sudden they found it. So usually what happens if you go through a cleanup and you remove all the food sources, within about 3 weeks, they're done. If you continue to get a trickle, what it suggests to me is you have overlooked something. Now, as to these traps, they are great for monitoring. They attract male moths. So it lets you know. And so you will catch moths in the traps when you can't even see moths around. They're that sensitive. But as a control fixture, it's not going to work because you still have females that are getting mated that are laying new eggs if they can find a new food source. So the pantry moth traps, as I said, are great for monitoring, but for a control strategy, it just isn't effective enough for it to do that. So pay attention. If it seems to be that all of a sudden you're seeing more of them in the bedroom than in the kitchen, then you've got something up in your closet that they have found to utilize. And they're good at jumping from one thing to the next. So that's something you always have to be careful of. And it's usually product, you know, the breakfast cereal that we all go through in 3 weeks and you get a new box, that's not enough time. You know, it's probably a 4 to 5 week life cycle. And again, you know, if the problem's in the basement, you got to get through all your boxes to see where they're coming from. And in the kitchen, I even worry about things that spill behind drawers and whatnot is being enough to fuel the problem.
There you go, Levon. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Back to the outdoors again for just a few minutes. This wet weather, what has it meant just in general for insect populations?
Well, the classic is when you have that much standing water, we get lots of mosquitoes. And, you know, PJ and I have corresponded. Both of us, I think, were somewhat amazed that it took the mosquitoes as long to go crazy considering how wet we've been. And so it wasn't until well until the end of June that things really started to get, at least in our areas of Madison, start to get to be extremely disappointing. And it's been pretty consistent since then, and we continue to get the rains. And so for other insects, it's a little harder to predict. Generally speaking, when we get a lot of moisture, that tends to promote a lot of natural insect diseases, especially fungal diseases. So more often than not, box elder bugs and caterpillars and other things have a hard time because the humidities promote these diseases. On the other thing, the classic creatures like spider mites and other things that we associate with dry weather, they are totally shut down. I mean, they don't do well under this environment. So there's always winners and losers, unfortunately, in this situation. So, overall, it's I have not seen it to be a bad insect year. Although I'm somewhat sheltered now, it's not. I don't get near the kind of inquiries as I did when I was running the lab. But you know, just watching what's going on in my backyard is, you know, overall, and I think part of that is if you provide plants with enough moisture and other things, they can kind of outgrow some of the insect injury.
Yeah.
And there are some people. I'm not a big proponent of this that stress plants attract more insects, and there's some partial truth to that. But you can kind of overplay it, so the less stress, you know, the less. Successful some of these insects are going to be.
Oh. Well, let's go to Dennis in Stoughton next. Dennis, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. I've got concrete driveway, and between the slabs, I noticed there's a little hole and a big pile of soil. It looks like soil to me, just dark granules of soil. And I went over there and kicked the pile a little bit, and I thought I saw a hornet or a wasp come out and be somewhat irritated.
Mm-hmm.
So are these wasps or hornets, and how can I deal with that being that it's in front of my garage door?
Sure. So if I had to guess, because this I would assume is happening within the last 3 weeks or so?
Yes.
Okay. What you probably have is a cicada killer, which is the largest species of wasp that we have in the state. But it's not a nest per se, because these are what we call solitary wasps. And what they will do is fly up in the trees, paralyze the cicada by stinging it, and then they dig a hole in the ground. And that's what you're witnessing between the slab, is this hole that it's dug. It drops the cicada in there, it lays its egg, and then it's done with it. Because of that solitary behavior, this not being a nest, they really are not very aggressive. They might be a little curious when you show up. But you know, normally, if you had a paper wasp nest in the ground and you disturbed it, you would have got stung multiple times. They would not tolerate that. So you can ignore it if you'd like. If you would prefer for it not to be there, what I would suggest is just get a powdered insecticide, and critter doesn't need to be there. You just sprinkle a little of the dust down the hole and you're done. Because when it comes and goes, it will die. But and this is a relatively speaking recent introduction in the state. You know, when I was a graduate student and first started in the lab, we never saw cicada killers here. I used to tease my colleague Dave Hogg was from Indianapolis and Indiana area, and you know, it was very common down there, so I always called it an Indiana insect. Well, you know, that changed probably about 10-15 years ago, probably because of the milder winters. So they are quite well established. They don't show up until we get into July when the cicadas come out, because that's their only prey. Yeah. And so, as I said, now if you'd rather not kill it, they're fascinating to watch. Sometimes you'll see them come into an area like that, and the hole isn't big enough to get the cicada in. They'll keep trying to push it down there. They finally give up, leave the cicada, and rather than thinking they would learn from that, they go catch another cicada, come back. And so sometimes you'll see four or five paralyzed cicadas outside the hole. It usually is a factor that they couldn't get the opening big enough to stuff them down in there.
There you go. Dennis, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Whether it's a statue, a memorial, or a highway, what should we do with Confederate symbols in public? That discussion is coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock on our new program, 1A. In the meantime, Larry Mueller here with Phil Pelletieri from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's now an emeritus, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, retired in 2014, and we're talking insects with him. And I hope you'll join in. Send your insect photo. We've already getting quite a few here at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, phone at 1-800-642-1234. Sally in Sussex up next with a question for you, Phil. Sally, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, my question is about box elder bugs. And we live in a house that the back of the house, which is on the east, there is a kind of wood field area can't be built on. There's some little creek that goes through there. And because of that, we get so many box elders, you know, in the fall. Now, most years I've controlled them with just spraying a little mixture of dish soap and water. But last year, they were just unbelievable. I had like a screen door that was just so covered with them. Now, I know some of my neighbors say they control them by having some kind of spray put down. Now, I'm not sure if that's on the lawn or the house. I don't know if I want to go that route, but I'm wondering if there's any better way to control them than what I'm doing.
Sure. Well, you know, when we try to walk through, you know, a more permanent solution, which probably will not fit in your situation, is if you got rid of the trees that are breeding them, which is primarily box elder, but is also silver maple. So once in a while, we get a case where there's an isolated tree or two, those trees are removed, they no longer can breed. But if you've got a wild area around you, box elder is such a common fence row tree and a woodlot tree. So they go through two cycles, and then in the fall, they look for shelter. And that's the problem that you've got, is that they are migrating, looking for any place to crawl under, whether it's a wood pile, a rock pile, or into your house. Now, the soap is very effective, but only kills on contact. So if there's 20 of them on the side of the house and you spray them with your soapy water, you get them, but there's no residual. What the more long-term residual insecticides do is you spray once, and they may kill them for 3 or 4 weeks. So that's the advantage. It's always working. And you usually see most of the congregation on the sunnier sides of the house, because if you watch box elders in the cool mornings, they're often cold enough they don't even move, but they are attracted to the heat. And once things start to warm up and they get sunny, they start crawling around, and that's when they work their way under your siding, through the windows, on your screen. And you know, the tighter the house is, the less problem you will have indoors. But the problem with them is if they get indoors, you pay for it all winter long till the next spring. I mean, it's, you know, and people get very frustrated. And once you get into this late October, early November, you've really already lost any opportunity to stop them from coming in. So going back, the option is when you see them congregated, you can use your soap spray. If you would rather not treat as many times, whether you contract for service or go to the hardware store and get something with more residual. And again, you spray outside. There's no reason to spray inside for this. Many of the sprays have both a combination of repellency, and a killing power. And in particular, you try to put it in, if you had to air, you air more high because they tend to crawl upwards when they tend to get in. Now, interesting enough, we'll see if my prediction holds, but if we continue to get reasonable rains, this would suggest to me that the main naturally population control is a fungus disease. And generally speaking, wet late summers and falls, we don't have many box elder bugs. The drier the year, the more problematic. Now, I've been surprised a couple of times when my observations don't always hold true, but generally I get the most nervous in droughty periods in the late summer and the least nervous when things stay wet. And so that may suggest, and we're getting close. You're probably starting to see the first trickling. I usually think about first of September is when the wave is coming, and that's when you really you got to decide what your line of defense will be, because that time in the first 2 or 3 weeks of September either makes or breaks your success.
Harry? So you actually spray the house, the siding?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we move to Kevin in Baraboo next. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, hi, Larry and Phil. Actually, this is Kevin from my studio that's between Merrimack and Prairie du Sec, a little bit off of Highway 78. I live in Baraboo, but I'm a metal sculptor out here, and I'm kind of dealing with my third bout of Lyme's disease. I do spray myself when I get out here. I do have my work area is kind of underneath an oak tree and things like that. But my real question is that, I know mosquitoes are great food for birds. Where do ticks lie in the food chain?
Well, not a lot different. Interestingly enough, one of the ways that culturally they control them is to have chickens or guinea fowl, because ticks tend to be down on the ground, and all their pecking and whatnot, they tend to be pretty good at picking them up. They also have some wasp parasites and the like. But, kind of like mosquitoes, if I removed all the mosquitoes and ticks in the world, I think the wildlife would do quite well, because there's so many other insects to feed on. And so from a human perspective, it's hard to kind of understand the dynamic here, in because you can't say much nice about either of those because of both the nuisance aspect, but more importantly is that they vector some very serious human diseases. And
There's tall grass close by, but I really don't venture out into that anymore. Mm-hmm. Like I said, my work area for making metal sculpture is underneath an oak tree. I do have an old truck backtop thing cover over me, so I don't have that.
The one thing, whatever you can do, I don't know if it's reasonable to mow, but when you typically talk about the average lawn is a tick desert, let alone, you can carry it one step further, and if you have a large beach area, you don't find ticks there. They are quite sensitive to desiccation, and so typically wherever the moisture levels are higher, which is the long grass, lots of dense undergrowth, that's where the ticks are the happiest, and we definitely see that relationship going on. And it's been interesting to watch this evolution as the percentage of ticks carrying disease keeps going up. And we keep finding new diseases. And so if you're at all an outdoor person, anytime there is no snow on the ground, it's potentially tick season. And I think you really have to keep aware of that. And if you're in an area where ticks are quite frequent, as you do, spray your clothing. Many of the sprays you put on now, if you have like work coveralls or the like, the
last
spray will last
weeks.
Yeah, sometimes through 2 or 3 washings. And so I think, for gardeners and whatnot, it's good to have pre-treated clothing to put on, do that. The permethrin that is the standard treatment for there, if the ticks walk on it, they will not survive. And so that's why I'm more comfortable with that. I think it's a more reasonable treatment than the mosquito repellents like DEET, which really don't kill them. It just prevents them from going on the area you treat. You can sweat it off. So as I said, the clothing treatments, I think, offer some additional protection. But the cultural thing you can do is anything you can do to keep it, the grass low, things kind of dry in your work area will be in your favor.
Yeah, I guess this is probably a question that you don't really have the answer, because maybe it's a more medical one. But like I said, I'm going to see my doctor tomorrow because I have gotten positive for Lyme disease for the third time. But is it Lyme disease something that you can be, you know, you show that you've got it forever, you know, after you get it once?
Well, there's a couple points. You know, some of the newer blood tests are, from what I understand, are capable of separating a new acquired versus an old disease, you know, and whereas that, you know, it takes kind of a sophisticated test. But and then the other side of it, which is a kind of unanswered scientific question, is if you contracted Lyme disease and you went through a treatment, did you remove all the spirochetes from your system or not? And, you know, that's an extremely hard question to answer. In general, though, is if it is treated early before it goes into some of the more complicated autoimmune responses, they have very good success at treating it. But people who had a long-term problem with this before it was diagnosed often have reoccurring problems. And again, putting your finger exactly what causes this is not easy. And as I said, I don't know of anybody who can come up with a definitive answer there. Is do you still have some spirochetes in your system that are causing some of the further complications or not? And but with a new blood test, they, as I said, can differentiate just the way your body's responding. Is it a newly acquired or an older disease, from what I understand?
Yeah. Well, the first time I had it, I had a temperature of like 103. I don't have that. I just sort of feel more body aches and pains and stuff like that. But I also, I'm in my 60s and I played football in high school and college. So I'm just wondering, you know, if some of that is that's going on or what really was.
Yeah. It could be some arthritis there too.
Right. So one of the things that is the normal recommendation now, and I think everybody should be aware of this. Most physicians are, but just in case you can kind of bring them up to snuff, is the percentage of ticks in the state that are carrying the disease is ranging somewhere 35-40% is not unusual to find. And the CDC guidelines tell us that if we have above 20% infectivity level, we're above that, that you knew it was a deer tick and you knew it was on your person for approximately 36 to 48 hours. If you treat the person within the first week or so with one day's dose of doxycycline, you basically stop the disease. And that's because it's very localized. Where you talk to people that have a much more longer antibiotic regimen is when it has moved through your system. It has moved out and it's harder to get. So, you know, I ran into it. I looked on my shoulder about a month and a half ago, and there was this funny little swelling that turned out to be an immature nymphal deer tick. The way it was swollen, I had no question that it was there long enough. So, you know, I emailed my family physician and asked for antibiotic and treated it right up front. You know, it cost me, I think, a whole 68 cents for the antibiotic and no problems. And so, as I said, this is the standard way we are to approach this now. If you know it's a deer tick, if you know it was there long enough because of the level of infectivity that we see, this will also take care of some, you know, anaplasmosis and a couple of the other diseases also.
Oh, there we go. Thank you very much for calling, Kevin. Appreciate your call. I want to give Eric in Wisconsin Dells a chance to join in. Eric, it's your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, Bill and Larry. I got a less ominous story. Last night I caught a bug. It was the coolest little bug I've ever seen. It was like a walking stick or a walking bug, or a stick bug, I guess they call them.
Yeah.
But it was only like an inch and a quarter long at the most, and its legs were probably three quarters of an inch long, and they were like human hairs thin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I don't know if this was a familiar bug. It was all black with a little couple white stripes on its legs, but I put it on a paper plate to show my wife. And actually, I hate to use the word levitated, but it like flew about 9 inches across from this plate to my refrigerator door without wings. It was kind of an interesting, I don't know if it's just that light, it could almost float on air or what.
And you didn't see wings, because typically, first of all, there is one creature we call a stilt bug that would fit that description. And honestly, there's a couple other little assassin bugs that have that very elongated walking stick-like feature, but they're quite a bit smaller and more fragile legs. Which is interesting because these are predators rather than being a plant-feeding critter like a walking stick. So
sorry to interrupt. I was curious what it eats, and I'll send pictures on the website here in a minute.
Okay.
It got very aggressive. When it went to the edge of the plate, I touched it with my finger to push it back in the middle of the plate. It got very aggressive.
Yeah, that kind of behavior is also suggestive of a predaceous critter to me. And as I said, whether it is the stilt bug or one of these elongated assassin bugs, that would be my first guess. And everything it's doing would fit that pattern. They're small enough that most people, unless they're right out in front of you, you probably would overlook them. They're really more common than people think, but they're very subtle when they're out in the flowers and whatnot, moving around, and you wouldn't normally pick them up.
Yeah. Send a photo to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And speaking of photos, Jay sent a photo of a horsehair worm, as he calls it.
Yeah, and he's got it. So these are parasites of crickets and grasshoppers and the like. So they're insect problems, but you see them. They remind you of tapeworms and other things. You typically see them after rains, when they are on the soil surface, and they're 3 or 4 inches long, but very skinny. The old adage was that if you dropped horsehair into a pail of water, it would turn into a worm. Well, what probably happened is an infected cricket fell into the pail of water and the horsehair worm emerged. So nothing to worry about, people. Kind of a curious little creature, kind of a unique creature. As I said, if you normally expect to find them. I see them in the mornings after, at least a heavy dew, if not a rain. They don't do well. Things are dry, and so I think they lay pretty low when you get those conditions.
And Scott sent a photo of a ferocious-looking insect.
Right. Pelecynid is the name of the wasp group. These are parasites of creatures in this particular group. They're parasites of grubs in the lawn. Oh. And they use this long abdomen to get their eggs down into the soil so that their larvae can develop on grubs that are there. There are other types of wasps that have variations on this that are parasitic of various wood-boring insects.
Oh.
So they generally look kind of scary because any wasp with a long abdomen like that, you think, holy cow.
That's a long
abdomen.
But as I said,
they are basically more insect parasites in the way their life cycles go than anything else. If you think of the movie Alien, that's what their larvae do, is eat the inner sides of other insects out and stuff.
Okay. Well, we'll go back to some more photos, but let's go to Peggy in Mondovi next. Peggy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, good morning, Larry and Phil.
Morning.
I have a question about wasps. Our daughter just bought a house that has a hot tub out and back, and they're finding that they have wasps that are living in the insulation. The hot tub itself is insulated with bats of insulation, and then over that is a wooden panels of wooden decorative wood siding.
Sure.
And the wasps are going in between the cracks of the wood, and they're getting behind the bats of insulation. So what they're wondering is, first of all, are they going to winter over with the nice cozy conditions of the hot tub?
No.
And how can they get rid of them and prevent them?
So wasps do not store food. So it doesn't matter how warm it is, they have no way to sustain themselves. And so it may be true that they can hang on an extra couple weeks in the fall because the warmer conditions, but typically what happens is everybody starves to death anyway, and what their life cycle is every spring the new queens that have spent the winter under a rock or whatnot start everything from scratch. Now the problem is you're probably going to experience at least another 6 or 7 weeks of activity, and so if they're going to try to use the hot tub, it's going to be a problem. And I can't even assure them that at night, when there's kind of a ruckus and activity, that there wouldn't be some potential of getting stung, although it's far more active during the day. Now, when you can see a nest, it's sitting up in a tree or a bush, the aerosol wasp sprays that you buy at the hardware store are the best way to go. But when you cannot see the nest, the problem is they can spray in between the slats, and they more likely than not will be disappointed with the results. And so for anything in the ground or something like this, we have to use a dust instead. And to apply the dust, and this is going to be a little tricky, if they're all going between one particular slat and you've got an isolated place to treat, life is much easier. If they're going in from 5 different places, I'm a little more concerned, because what you have to do is blow the dust into that crack or crevice, whether you use In some cases, these things have applicators already to go. There's something called a bulb duster that you can get at some hardware stores. You can even use just an old turkey baster or a squeezed mustard bottle where you put the dust in and blow the dust in. And I would prefer to do that in right away in the morning, just when the sun comes up, or you can wait until the evening when the sun's going down. And the ideal situation is when it's a very cool situation where they're much less active. And so, unfortunately, we're talking 50 degrees-ish,
yeah,
which is not an easy temperature to come by now. It'll be a little more common as we go on. But as I said, if it's an area of high people traffic, you cannot see where the nest is. You can dust. I guess the only other concern is if people in the household are allergic, then they may want to contract for service where somebody comes in and treats it for them. But it's more of a case of using the right stuff, putting it in the right spot. And it may be worth just sitting back for an hour or so and just watch them coming and going to see if you can isolate those spots that need treating. Don't treat in the middle of the day, because the wasps that are out and about foraging will come back and they will not be happy. They will be quite agitated. And so, as I said, I'd like to have them as much surrounded as possible, which is either quite late or quite early in the day.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Peggy. And Kate and Holman, your turn now. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Quick question about a river birch that I have. I've got a couple dozen river birches. One of them, though, has teeny tiny holes all over it, and they're surrounded pretty much the whole day by wasps and bees digging into those holes. I'm wondering a couple of questions. What caused it? Is the birch dead? I don't want to kill the bees and wasps. What's going on here?
Well, if they appear to be going in the holes, I think they're utilizing some pre-existing bark beetle holes, because there's a number of wasps and bees that's what they do, is they look for dead wood in trees that have already pre-existing holes, and that's how they provision their nests and raise young.
Okay.
So it's a sign that something isn't totally right, because a healthy plant wouldn't allow the bark beetles to be successful. But as far as there's even some species of wasps, like wood wasps, that breed in dead wood, the like. But this doesn't sound, when you said there's also bees in there. Now, the other thing you will see sometimes when trees are bleeding because of bacterial cankers or other things, you will also see wasps come in to pick up the resins and the like. But with your observation of pre-existing holes, now, are the holes quite uniform on the trunk?
Woodpeckers.
They look like they were woodpecker holes.
Okay. Well, what I was fishing for there is sapsuckers, when they attack trees, will leave very uniform holes that look like bark beetle holes. And the sapsucker does this on purpose to make the holes bleed so it can feed on the sap. And, of course, then it attracts various insects at times, too. But if it's a more rather pattern, and if woodpeckers are messing with the tree also, that suggests they're after whoever's in there, whether it's the bees, wasps, or the bark beetles, because that's woodpecker's primary food. So, I'm a little concerned there's some dead wood in the tree. But until you start to see major dieback or whatnot, I mean, there's really not a whole lot to worry about there.
There we go.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Larry Mueller here with Phil Pelletieri, our insect expert. And Phil, remember we had a call from Eric about a bug you thought was a stilt bug,
right,
but weren't sure. He sent a photo in. So it's a nice photo with a quarter placed by it.
Right, and that is a stilt bug, and he did a very good job of describing it. That fineness of the legs, almost hair-like, is probably the giveaway, whereas, as I said, an immature walking stick that could be that small has a much stouter leg going about it. And so these are predators on other small insects.
Worth having around?
Oh, yeah. These are good guys. And you'll never be overrun by them, because that's typical of predators. There's not near as many of them as aphids and some of the other things that they feed on.
Mary Sue in West Bend, it's your turn. Hi, Mary Sue.
Hi, good morning. I have another solitary wasp question. For the last couple of years, around the end of July and early August, I've been finding numerous wasp corpses on the floor of my basement recreational room. And once in a while, I'll find some live ones on the window, but mostly it's just dead bodies. And I'm wondering what's killing them and why they choose my basement as their final resting place. And
That's quite typical when you have paper wasp nests in your wall voids or possibly even your attic. And typically they'll come and go from an opening on the outside, but sometimes they get mixed up. And in particular, I think what happens is if the lights on are at night, they see the light and they're attracted to it. So they can kind of filter down and come through your sill plates or light fixtures or other things. And of course, that's a dead end for them because they can't get out. You know, can't find anything to sustain themselves. There's no water to drink. And so they typically die. And I honestly get the complaint more in the later summer and fall than I do midsummer, just because the number of wasps is increasing exponentially right now. The colonies are still under their growth pattern. Whereas in the spring, when there's only, you know, a handful at best of wasps, you don't observe this. But as I said, it's got to be that there's someplace within the house, which is typically the voids within your wall spaces, that they're probably coming in and out from the siding. So it'd be worth taking a walk outside on a nice sunny day and just kind of watch for activity to see if you can. It might even be as high as the soffits up in the overhangs. But as I said, I think what might be going on is at night when the lights are on, some of them get confused. They're drawn to the light, per se, which draws them down into the basement.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you very much for calling. A nice photo from Deb, who wonders what this really camouflage clothing-looking moth is.
So, you know, this is a big creature. You know, the wings span, if the wings were out, is going to be approaching 4 inches. This is the great poplar sphinx is the name of it. So it's a hawk moth or a sphinx moth. It's in that family. It is one of the largest and also, I think, very ornate, just that these neat shades of green and variation. Yeah. So they're very artsy if you look at them that way, and seem to be having a reasonable year. As I said, I don't see near the kind of traffic I did when I was running the lab, but I've had 3 or 4 people send me pictures of these at home that they have run into.
Very cool picture.
Yeah.
Equo, in who's near St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
How are you doing?
We're doing great. Yes, so we're calling in because we actually just drove out here from Boston to do some nature tourism and canoeing in the area. And it so happens that one of my friends in the trip with me is from the Dominican Republic, and he's really into insect photography. So I'm hoping you could give us some suggestions for some unique or cool-looking insect that he might look out for.
Well, one that would be worth... It will be challenging, but if you can get some pictures, tiger beetles, many of them are quite metallic. If you get up close and personal, they are a stunning creature with these great big sickle-shaped jaws and all kinds of interesting hairs with that metallic background. The problem with them is, although they're quite common in sandy areas and like, so if you're canoeing, you might run into some areas that they're quite frequent, they're very nervous creatures. And so, you know, you tend to try to sneak up on them, and you got to be quite careful. If you can go, there's a site called Wisconsin Butterflies. If you go to that site, and unfortunately, the gentleman that takes these pictures, I can't think of his name, and I apologize to him because he's an old friend. But he also has pictures of Wisconsin tiger beetles. So you both can get an idea of what they're like. But what I admire so much about his site, aside from being very educational, is he took a majority of these pictures himself. And knowing the challenge it is to take pictures of tiger beetles, but that would be the first thing I can think of. As they said, they're stunning on themselves because they're metallic. And then the closer you get with macro lenses and whatnot, they're really quite interesting. And the thing that will be helpful about his website will tell you the areas of the state you can find it, the habitat you can find it, and when they're active, because we have a number of species in the state. Another one that he specialized now, the tiger beetles weren't challenging enough, so he's moved on to something called robber flies, which are even more difficult to chase down with a camera. So I very much admire, and he's got a great site in Wisconsin Butterflies, so you kind of get three treats for the price of one.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, and good luck with the photography. Appreciate it very much. Gary in Clam Lake, on to you now. Hi, Gary.
Hey, thank you. Great show.
Thanks.
I've had wasps and sweat bees, or whatever you want to call them, in areas that were inaccessible with the nest and so on. And my solution to that was to use a shop vacuum, and about an hour before sunset, set that shop hose just in front of their entrance. And they come back, and then they swoop back and forth, until they finally swoop into their hole, and then they get sucked into the vacuum. And when that's after sunset and at dark, they I'll spray in there some bug spray and then close off the end until the next evening. My son and I did this down in Illinois, and the wasps were underneath an air conditioner, and we decided to count them when we were done. It took several days on this one, and we stopped counting at 9,000.
Oh, my.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you know, that's probably getting on the high end, but it doesn't totally surprise me.
They kept getting smaller as time went on because, of course, their food supply was not coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was amazing. I have pictures of it, but unfortunately it's on my computer in Illinois.
And one of the things I've always been intrigued with, so all of our species in this climate are, you know, one generation die out in the fall. But if you get down into some of the southern climates, there is evidence of the nests sustaining themselves because it's both there's food available and it's warm enough to fly. And so I've seen pictures of nests that could be 2 or 3 years old. And honestly, they're as big as the size of a Volkswagen in some case. I mean, it's just, to me, mind-boggling. And I can only imagine if I was in charge of trying to take care of that. I don't think I had to have enough bug spray to treat a nest that's large, so you know it can be quite concerning. So,
we had the sweat bees or what yellow jackets, whatever you call them, in the ground, and the boys would find them when they were walking through the woods up here, and I found that just a little Dawn soap and a gallon of water, and then go over there at night and pour it down the hole, and that stops him.
Yeah, if it all has to do with how where the nest is located versus the hole. In some cases, when they're using old rodent burrows, there's a drainage system already built in. It's the same reason, you know, if I had people tell me they put gasoline down there, which is not a good idea. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes they light the gas, sometimes they don't. I am not a proponent of either way type of thing. But the soap is worth trying. The warning would be, in some cases, if it doesn't drain right into the nest, then you've got a problem because they won't a problem, but it won't control them.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Gary. Robin in Madison has something for us next. Hi, Robin.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a bunch of milkweed around my home, and it's completely covered with taconid flies. Now, I understand that they're beneficial, so I don't want to control them. But are the monarch caterpillars, are they actually surviving this fly infestation? Or should I just pull up all my milkweed and just call it a day?
Oh, no, it's not worth pulling milkweed out. There are tachinids, there is a large number of species. They are parasites of various insects. There are tachinid parasites of monarchs. The question is, are the ones you're seeing the right ones, and that I can't answer for you. Normally they don't hang out unless there's a reason, you know. And the other thing is, do the flies appear to be stuck on the leaves, or when you come by they fly away?
Well, they do fly away, but I also have some other plants near the milkweed, and they do get stuck on those.
Okay. The reason I was asking the question is that there is a fungus disease that attacks various species of flies, and one of the things when they die is it's almost like they're glued on the edges of leaves. So, you know, yes. I used to see people would send me a picture of 10 flies glued on the leaf and wonder what the devil's going on. And that's just where they die. That's their behavior. And so that would suggest you've got these normal cycles going through and nothing to worry about the monarchs. So one way or another, if there are natural tachinids there, you know, when people do have monarch caterpillars on some milkweed, if they bring it inside and raise the caterpillars inside, they'll have a much higher success rate, because if they leave them outdoors to their natural cycles, there's enough parasites, predators, and whatnot that it's tough sledding for the monarchs to get through. And the tachinids are just one of the hassles that we have with monarchs. So, you know, if you're into really serious rearing, you know, in some cases people will cage their plants once they have things to keep some of these headaches away. Mm-hmm. or bring the stuff.
I can't remember what it's called. Like one of those covers, like a row cover.
Yeah, a row cover, but you almost have to keep it totally. It's interesting. There's a project I know down in Iowa where they will bring people. They're almost like walk-in tents that people are putting in their backyard with milkweed, and they'll even send people little monarch caterpillars to raise them again under this moderately protected environment. And then, of course, once you get the adults, you let them go. And so, if you're really serious, it's worth again building little cages that you can put on the plant once you've got some larvae to try to protect them from some of their natural enemies.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks so much for calling, Robin. Deborah in Monroe, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling about a beetle called an eastern blood-sucking cone nose. We first encountered this beetle maybe 15, 20 years ago when my husband was bitten by one, and it was a bump that was painful and itchy and stuck around for a long time. I'm wondering under what conditions they thrive, where they prefer living, and what could we do to stop them from coming into the house?
Sure.
Yeah.
A couple things. It's not a beetle. It's a true bug. The true cone-nose bugs, which are blood feeders, are not found in Wisconsin. They're found in Texas and south and through South America, where they spread something called Chagas disease, which is very serious. But we have some lookalikes here that are related but are not blood feeders. And in particular, the masked hunter bug is a quite common one that you can find both indoors and outdoors in Wisconsin. They will leave a very painful bite if you were to handle one, but they don't feed on blood or cause those kind of problems typically. So I think you've got one of those. They are predators, so I suspect they're coming from your attic, and we'll pick up on it, I think, after the news.
Yeah, well, so stay listening, Deborah. And you stay listening, too. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison, our guest today. He will be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Phil. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of insects today with retired entomologist Phil Pelletieri from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. You may have an insect problem or question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Phil, before we broke for the news, Deborah in Montrose.
Right, we're talking about cone-nose bugs, which are the blood feeders, but the Wisconsin look-alike is called the masked hunter bug. Name refers to that the nymphs cover themselves with dust, so they look like walking dust balls, really kind of curious little creatures. The adults are dark brown to almost black, about an inch long, and as I said, are almost a dead ringer for cone-nose bugs. They're a little bit smaller than what the true blood feeders are. They used to be called masked bed bug hunters, which is kind of an interesting term. But it refers to them feeding on various insects that are around, and so typically they're in secluded places like attics. But they still filter down in the house. I mean, you don't expect a lot of them because there's not a lot of insects in most people's houses. And secondly, especially in your living space, I mean, you wouldn't put up with it, but they do filter down. So, you know, I would look at soffit vents and roof vents to make sure they're screened in a way that insects can't get in. If insects can't get in, then these won't have anything to feed on. And so, like I said, I've never seen a place overrun with them. But the unfortunate thing is if you ever pick one of these things up and it decides to bite you, it is a very unpleasant experience. And so something you would not forget. So, you know, just as I said, kind of keep as much as you can. Insect activity down in the house would mean there's less for these things to eat and less likely they would be around.
Let's go to Robert in Madison next. Robert, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question about clothing moths. So I have a store that I sell fine cashmeres and wool online, and I noticed a few clothing moths around, so I've been starting to heat treat and Ziploc my clothes and bags and stuff since I can't afford to dry clean. And I was just wondering if you guys had any tips about how to manage and exterminate the clothing moths that I've been finding.
Well, have you found any larvae, you know, with the little case-making types, or there's one that doesn't make cases on any of your fabrics?
I've found remnants of the dead the dead larvae, because spiders have kind of gotten to a lot of them, and I've noticed some eggs on some of my clothing.
Okay, so what you might be noticing, so the dried pellets that come out of the caterpillars look like eggs, and that is the waste, and it is just this dry, fine, granular-type material. The reason I'm kind of fishing here a little bit is typically clean garments are far less likely to be attacked. And it's something that you would observe, and, what I would worry is it's a single piece or whatnot that's it's problematic. And it's usually stuff that is not disturbed very often. You know, the stuff that's out in front of you that you're moving around and whatnot, I think you'd both observe it, and these things do not like light. Now, both heat and cold are options. Cold is a little trickier because it's not just freezing. I mean, we typically think of 0 degrees and less to be sufficient. And one of the tricks that when you use cold is if you put the garments in a bag and freeze them for 4 or 5 days, you bring them out, you warm them up for 4 or 5 days to kind of, in case the insects survive, get them through it, and then you throw it back in the freezer, because what kills an insect is shock more so than the cold temperature itself. Closed moths can survive in bird nests out in the middle of the woods all winter long because they have a chance to acclimate. Now, heat's a little different. The thermal death point of most insects is about 112 to 115 degrees. So it's probably more efficient for you if you can heat things to that level. Then do what you've been doing is put them in basically moth-proof type bags. So that's really the better way to go, I think. But you almost have to go through all your items and carefully look at them, because, as I said, I find it's usually such, I've had more problems with people that have stored Oriental rugs in the closet as being the source of the clothes moth infestation than I do on the stuff that's out in their living space. I mean, that's just the way they work. I had an infestation in my own home, and it kind of drove me crazy because I've got a couple deer heads around. They will feed on animal hair. I have a couple, elk hides that I have, and I thought they were there. I didn't find it, and it's driving me crazy. Mm-hmm. And what I found out is they were in a bunch of turkey feathers that I use for making arrows. And I had them in a box and kind of put them away. And those were just dirty enough, because I hadn't quite cleaned them up. That's the stuff that the clothes moths were doing quite well in. And you could see the casings. You could see all that. As you described, they look like eggs, but they're the waste. And so all I did is freeze the devil out of it, and take care of it that way. But my gut feeling is if you can put the fire out, you're done, But trying to isolate that. Now, one other treatment that you can consider, and this is a little different, but there are no normal fumigants that we use. Now, let's say in a terrible situation, a pest control service could come in and fumigate the building to kill them out. Well, that's not practical. It's very expensive. But interesting enough, for spot treating things, and we've used the same trick for bed bugs. Let's say you have an infested suitcase. You don't want to spray it. You can't fit it in the freezer. You can't fit it in the oven. They sell an insecticide that is impregnated on a piece of plastic. The product is known as Vapona or DDVP. ProZap is one of the commercial names. Nuvon is another commercial name. And what's unique about this insecticide is in a closed environment, it gives off chemicals in a gas form. So what they would do is take the items, put them in a large plastic bag or something that you can seal, put one of these strips in there, and you're basically after 5 or 6 days fumigating anything that's in there. Now, you got to be a little careful with this. They used to use these in houses. They no longer allow them to be hanging in a house that there's a lot of people traffic, and there's some, how many hours a day type of thing. But when you're putting it in a bag out in the garage or whatnot, that's not a problem. And when you open it up, everything is gone. There's no chemical residue left behind. Where we've gotten into a little problems with these is when people have treated museum items that have various interesting glues and other things that sometimes the chemical can melt. But typically fabrics, it's not a problem. So I think the heating and cold is a better way to go. But under extreme conditions, if you had something, that was one other option that is available.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Robert. And Ann in Milwaukee, you are next. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to share some
simple ways of dealing with bee or wasp stings if you know what bit you.
Yep.
And this worked for me. For both of them, you're supposed to wash the area with soap and water to remove the venom, even though probably most of the venom is actually inside you. And then the difference between the bee and the wasp stings, you know, if it's a bee, you'll want to remove the stinger. But then to treat it, I didn't realize this because I'm not a scientist, but bee stings are acidic, so you're supposed to put baking soda on them. And wasp stings are alkaline, so you should put vinegar on them. And I thought, oh, that sounded really crazy. And I had gotten stung by a wasp and quick went to my cell phone and looked up how to treat it and found this out. And I did wash the area, and I put vinegar on. And usually a wasp sting for me would hurt for a couple days because it's pretty intense. And I will say that within a couple of minutes, all the pain was gone. And then I put vinegar back on just with a piece of paper toweling, you know, soaked with vinegar when it started to itch, you know, a couple days later when the sting was actually coming out. But this really worked, and it was very simple. So I just wanted to share that.
Okay. Well, thanks. I mean, I'll make a couple comments. I honestly don't know. There is differences in the venom. There's no question about that. The pH of it, I'm not familiar with. It makes sense, although to me, it'd be kind of hard how you interface what you put on the outside of your skin versus what's already injected. Now, the difference between bees and wasps, what do you have to take into account? That the only bee that leaves its stinger behind is the honeybee. Hmm. And that's because its stinger is barbed. Other types of solitary bees have just a barbed stinger that they can sting, and there's nothing left behind. But as you mentioned, the venom is different. So even with allergy problems, we find is that people can be allergic to wasp stings and not bees. They're not the same. And it has to do with the different types of venom that are responsible there. And more likely than not is that wasps are far more likely to be the culprits. Not always, but far more likely. And rarely do I see people get stung with honeybees. Although my sister-in-law and I had a conversation back three or four weeks ago, and you know, she started talking about it, and I was convinced it was a wasp sting until she shared with me that the stinger was left behind. And then there was only one explanation. It was a honeybee.
It was a honeybee. There we go. Thanks, Ann.
I should mention that the way I remember this is bee sting and baking soda and wasp and vinegar.
Yeah.
So that's the way that I will remember this when this unfortunate thing happens again.
Well, I'll have to try that. Unfortunately, I got zapped last week. I was up on the roof and, you know, I should know better. I was checking my vents, and I stuck my hand in a vent without looking in first.
Oh.
And it was, you know, I didn't get zapped that bad, but I was disappointed in myself for, for at this time of the year doing something as foolish as that. And and it's quite typical, as you had mentioned, in wasp stings, is, you know, aside from they often hurt quite a bit more swelling initially, but this intense itching 2 or 3 days afterwards is just as much of an irritation as the sting itself.
Yeah.
And the vinegar really helped with that too, you guys.
Okay. Thank you, Ann.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate that call. I have to go back to Facebook because there's a photo on Facebook that Linda sent. She saw this, and it looks like a smudge or a long greenish smudge.
Yeah, and I'm glad that Linda had solved this problem, as you can see on the posting. I didn't pick it up at first just because I didn't look carefully enough, but this is a migrating mass of fungus gnat maggots. And they do this, it's probably protection in numbers type of here, but it's this slimy little, almost looks like a worm crawling. But if you look at it very closely, every one of those little black things you see there is a head of a different maggot. And they will literally move from one area to the next this way. And it's kind of a fascinating observation when you see it, where typically you find it in places that are somewhat damp just because it's much in their favor to stay hydrated. But you may never see that again type of thing, but it's an interesting observation when you do. And if you get on the internet, look at it, you'll see some just, again, fascinating pictures of these, you know, dozens and dozens of maggots kind of moving in unison. And as I said, it almost looks like it's a single organism, but indeed it is made up of multiple critters.
Yeah, it's posted up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, along with a whole bunch of other insect photos, which are really cool. Jim and Larson, it's your turn now. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Now, I live up on Lake Boygan, and across the way from our place, we have a lot of marshland and swampy areas.
Yep.
And I've been debating whether to call for about 3 years now. my son and I, we both witnessed this a couple of different times. We'll be looking across out our front door, and we'll see almost like a whirlwind, kind of a tornado-type cloud coming out of there. And they're light, very light. We can never get a picture of them and stuff. And as we move aside, the light just kind of has to be just right. And they appear to be kind of a swarm of light green.
Critters, yeah. So in this phenomena of seeing swarms where they look like a cloud of smoke or something else, there's a number
of... they look like tornadoes. We're sitting right there. Should we tell anybody? Because it's like, almost like the invasion of the body.
Sure. You'll see columns of them, and so there's various aquatic insects that could do it, but your description of small light green, that's what I would describe as one of the species of lake flies. And those are typically clusters of males that swarm, and often they'll appear, if it's real windy, you don't expect it. They're such weak flyers, they can't keep the swarm together. But usually, at dusk when the wind's going down, you get these interesting phenomena, and you may see it in the same area three or four nights in a row.
Uh-huh.
That's not that unusual. And again, Poygan, if I remember, is kind of a somewhat shallow lake.
Yeah.
And so that's very conducive for the Chironobid lake flies. So I think you've got what we call them mating swarms. And what the idea is, these clouds of males are there, and then the females will come and fly in and find a mate and go from there. And again, the sheer numbers of these, I've seen pictures out of Canada on some of the lakes up there. The same thing, as you'd swear it was a tornado, or it was this space column going up in the air. And, it can be 100 feet deep. Type of thing in some cases. So it's an interesting phenomena. And you can go back there at, 2 o'clock the next day, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you go there at 7 o'clock and they appear again.
My God. So. Thank you so much. Because it's incredible. It's not hundreds. It's not thousands. It's a couple hundred feet high. That's just, I couldn't even imagine how many are in there at one time.
Yeah. Right. And sometimes you'll see birds taking advantage of these swarms. And, ant swarm, there's a whole bunch of critters that swarm. But the most common phenomenon I see is with insects associated with water, because there's a whole bunch of them that are relatively short-lived as adults. So this makes sense that they all get together, find mates real quick, and get things done, and don't waste any time doing that.
Oh, great. I feel so much better. Like I said, we've been seeing them for years, and I've been contemplating the last 2-3 years calling you guys as I've become a homeolaithite.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. That must be quite... Get a video of that. That would be a lot of fun to see, actually. Marnie in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Marnie.
Hi. I was calling because this year, and we've never had them before, we have had a bazillion millipedes, and they're really bad outside of our house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have a wood railing on our deck, and it's probably starting to rot. But, like, they'll just swarm it after a rainstorm. And we get, I find dead ones, quite a few in our basement this year, but very few live ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I was just curious, is there any way to get rid of them? Like, they're just in swarms this year.
So, the way I try to explain this to people is my ultimate solution is you make your whole backyard and everything around you a sandbox, because that's the environment you have no millipedes in. But when you get these incredible outbreaks, rather than saying, well, you can do this around your foundation to make them go away, they're migrating in from maybe as far as a quarter mile away. And so what happens when you get these population explosions of millipedes is they're moving around at night. And then when the sun comes up, they tend to accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dark. So it's quite common on people's garage floors, north side of the house next to the mulch. And in your case, you've got that softening up of the railing. That's a nice place to kind of get out of the sun, because they really can't get caught out in the sun for very long without dying. That's also what forces them indoors. So they crawl up underneath, where your foundation meets the siding. There's often enough space for millipedes to squeeze through, fall in the basement. It's dry, nothing to eat, because these are things that live in the soil and feed on rotting organic matter. So, in urban settings where there isn't that much organic matter, you don't see big outbreaks. in a lovely home out in a rural area where you've got great big grasslands next to you or big woodlots with all kinds of leaf litter, in the right conditions, as I said, you can just get these explosions. You know, I had people that would send me pictures of millipedes 4 to 6 inches deep along their foundation. You know, and you could instantly kill them all today and tomorrow. That number would pile up again because they're migrating in, as I said, from a distance. So I'm very reluctant to have people do much spraying around the house because it doesn't make much of a difference. And again, my experience when you get these large numbers, it's more a isolated phenomena. It will be interesting. Last year, as I said, it was wet in the late summer. Things were quite lush. That means there's a lot of dead vegetation. That gives me lots of millipedes. This year, the same thing. But usually when you get these huge outbreaks, it's like the populations crash. You know, there's so many. That's why they're leaving the area. They're looking for greener pastures type of thing. Okay. So unfortunately, you know, so in the short run, there's not any really good answers. Other than I said, you can try to keep things open, airy, dried out somewhat, that will lessen it. But if they're migrating in from distances away, as I said, that isn't going to solve anything in the long run.
So here's my other question is that, you know, mostly they're outside the house. We get them inside, but I rarely send them alive. They're usually dead, and they're just in the corner of the basement or the corner of the garage.
Sure.
And that doesn't really bother me. Like, are they harmful in any way? Or are they kind of like, can you just let them be?
Oh, no, you can definitely let them be. And I guess, you know, what I would normally suggest if they're problematic in the basement is to get down and caulk or stuff with, you know, some kind of batting or other material that interface between the siding and the foundation. Also, any vents that you've got coming out, make sure that they are sealed well enough that critters can't push through. Because as I said, it's a dead end. It's foolish on their part to come indoors because that's not a good habitat. And that's why they die so quickly. And other than large numbers get a little smelly, but other than that, they don't really cause any problems.
There you go. Thank you.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Pat in Oregon, what's on your mind?
Hi. We have a problem we've never noticed before. It's on a house up in Woodruff, Wisconsin, and it's an insect that has bored into the vinyl siding of our house. And it stays intact, and you pull it out, and, you know, kind of like the head is left behind. And it looks like some type of a moth, but we're not quite sure.
And you have a photo up, Pat, on our Facebook page, if I'm not mistaken.
A photo up.
I did send a photo already.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, good photo. So the critter is technically a type of bagworm. Now, when you do a search on bagworms, they talk about these big creatures on people's white cedar plants, but there are a bunch of other ones. This one is, I think, Solanobia, which is an old friend of mine from way back when. And so the weird story, these things feed on plant vegetation. They make cases, and the caterpillars live inside the case. And they migrate, and they will spin a little cocoon in this case. The moth comes flying out, and it looks like you might, you know, it looks like you just have a couple cases there. But the case is left behind, and it literally is almost like it's glued onto your house. So it's associated with the vegetation around you, and they just happen to utilize that surface. So they should scrape off pretty easily. I think just, you know, a good brush or whatnot would get them off. If you told me, boy, there's just gazillions of them, I hate these things, then you get to the point of in probably the June or so is to spray the vegetation around to kill the moths as they're going. Now, I don't know if I've ever seen them bad enough that it's worth that effort. So the good news is they don't hurt anything other than, you know, they physically kind of take away from the aesthetics. And so, as I said, you might have to every year kind of brush them back. But the weird thing about them, if you don't pull them off, that case can stay there for 3 or 4 years before it weathers off. So they kind of accumulate. And I know the first times I saw these, it drove me crazy until we finally figured out what we had. And they are related to the clothes moths, which come from a very similar family.
Oh.
But they don't eat wool, thank goodness.
Pat, thank you for calling. Phil, here we are out of time. Thank you so much. You're back on October 18th next time around. Thank you, Phil. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He is retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Tomorrow we'll be talking with our guests about problems that arise when kids go back to school, like homework issues and so forth. And then we'll take a look at custom knee implants. You stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.